sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets notching a new high on, well, anemic volume. German and British confidence levels plunge. U.S. housing market is seeming to report a continuation of expansion. We have a big week coming up for earnings. Over 203 companies in the S&P and Apple going to be reporting. And our guest today, a great guest, is Dr. Daniel Crosby, author of The Laws of Wealth, Psychology and the Secret to Investing Success. All this and much more on episode number 469 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I hope you're ready for a great show this week. We have a great guest, as I mentioned before, and some things I want to talk about with regard to what's going on with earnings season, what's happening with markets. I had the great opportunity to spend some time on the Benzinga pre-market show this week, and I'll be the guest on Frank Curzio's wonderful podcast next week, so you can pick that up. Of course, you can listen also each and every week to DH Unplugged, where myself and John C. Dvorak talk about all things that are related to markets, news, and kind of a different twist on what's really going on. Kind of really get down and dirty into some of the more interesting news, a little more offbeat news that's going on. Before we get started today, I want to mention that on this podcast, in the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, you'll find the Horowitz & Company economic commentary that we put out each and every quarter for our clients. Just a very quick tidbit of some of the more interesting things that are going on. We talk a little bit about economics. We talk about market trends. We talk about some of the things that are happening, different things each quarter. This quarter, we touch upon the idea of the hunt for yield. What's going on with some of these assets? Why are the markets moving up the way they are? Why are investors favoring yield type of assets than others right now? You can go over to the show notes of this episode, and you can download your copy. So just go over there, over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Go to episode number 469. The other thing I want to mention is that if you have a favorite guest that you've listened to on this show, you can go over to the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and there's a, on the tab on the top, there's a podcast search area, and you can actually search by guest or maybe by a stock symbol. You can find out what's going on from a variety of different filters and then play the podcast right from there as well. So a different way that you can actually search. So if you say, well, hey, I've listened to this guest before and I really like him or her and I'd like to hear what else he said in the past, you could just go and do a drop down for that particular guest. And you can see all the guests that actually were on. So you see a nice history. And then all the shows that they appeared on will be right there. So that's kind of a cool feature that we've added recently to the site, amongst other things. Of course, you can also listen on iTunes and your favorite Stitcher or iHeartRadio, Spreaker. There's a bunch of different places you can listen to the podcast and download it as well. Or just use your iPhone or your smartphone and you can get the information there. Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that are happening. I mentioned that the market is notching new highs. We did see that there was a little bit of a hiccup on Thursday, just one day out of the last 10 that markets were not up, the Dow Jones Industrial Average in particular. We're talking about the S&P also has been on a pretty good streak recently. And ever since the bottom of post-Brexit, after we saw many central banks coming out with promises of stimulus, the latest one being Japan, who by over the weekend, by the way, the Bank of Japan stated that they are not going to at all be involved in, quote, helicopter money, whereas they would just do a maybe a bond purchase program at zero and a perpetual basis where there's no interest payable and money just gets shoved right into the economy. Something that was speculated to be happening after the Bank of Japan and Shinzo Abe and Kuroda met with Ben Bernanke a couple of weeks ago. There was this discussion floating around that they would provide some kind of helicopter money. And you saw what happened with the yen. The yen, which ticked down to a level against the dollar of 98 or so, which means that the dollar had weakened and the yen had strengthened into the post-Brexit news. There was a flight to safety, people buying the yen, getting out of their short positions. And since then, the yen has weakened back to 106 against the U.S. dollar, a pretty substantial move. And the Japanese markets have also been on a move higher. Regardless of the fact that Japan is mired in a multi-decade deflationary spiral with an aging population, the fact remains that they are trying their best to manipulate the currency in such a way that their export-focused and centralized economy is going to do well, or at least maintain their competitiveness against other areas and other countries and other products outside of Japan. That is not necessarily helping, and we haven't seen any kind of benefit to the change in their inflationary pressures or deflationary pressures. Can't seem to reach that magic 2% rate of inflation that they've tried so desperately to do through so many fiscal and, I would say, non-traditional programs from the central bank. But since that Brexit low, amazingly, there's been a resurgence in the desire to buy stocks. I guess a lot of it has to do with, as I've talked about many times, that the central banks have gone into overdrive in almost a panic. They're panicked over the fact that what could be. And we did see that already, even though the pre-Brexit numbers in the UK were looking pretty good, right now we're starting to see signs like the confidence levels that have been recently put out, as well as their manufacturing levels, are back to somewhere about the 2008-2009 levels, and that's pretty bad. And a lot of it has to do with their currency being at an 85-year low, and with that, the potential it can go a lot lower if, in fact, the central bank, the Bank of England, comes in and decides that they're going to provide some kind of additional stimulus, even though after the last meeting a couple of weeks ago, they decided, no, we're not going to do anything at this point. We're going to hold off, which I think was a pretty good idea. It was a good idea because what it did was it enabled the Bank of England to keep a carrot out there that if things did get worse and things change, we have some room, we have scope. We can actually provide some additional stimulus. But we're also seeing that in Germany, a horrific event over the weekend that is supposedly non-terrorist related. Nonetheless, it's a continuation of this, you know, this horrific amount of violence that we're seeing around the world. And with all of the refugee issues and the concern about what's happening within Europe, obviously the confidence levels in Germany are also plummeting. And that's not a good sign from the strongest country in that area, and really the anchor to all of the Eurozone in itself. The good news, as I mentioned earlier, the housing market continues to point to continuing expansion. We did see that the numbers last week were better than expected. Still a little bit of a consolidation of the numbers, but still nothing to look at as like, wow, this is getting weak, it's falling off. And you'd expect that to be the case with interest rates at some of the lowest levels we've seen in forever. I mean, you know, when you have 30 years at the levels you have it and mortgages at the levels you have it, the fact is that while pricing of houses probably will be increasing due to that, the cost factors long term makes it so beneficial to get into a house at this point that more and more people are doing so. And obviously, the more houses, the more construction you have. And that just goes into the whole framework of the continuation of employment and the economy expanding, albeit at a slower pace. No, I mean, the fact is that we don't have a lot of inflation. Demand is good, not terrific, but it's all just status quo right now, and that's really good. Now, before we get to our guest, I wanted to mention that earnings. So we've seen a lot of earnings come out. About 25% of the companies in the S&P 500 have already reported, and about 57% have reported earnings above the mean estimate. And 68% have reported above the mean estimate for earnings, and 68% and 57% have reported sales above the mean estimate. Now, according to FactSet, earnings growth for quarter two 2016 is showing right now a blended decline of -3.7%. And if this continues, we're going to see the first time the index has recorded five consecutive quarters of year-over-year declines in earnings since quarter three of 2008 through quarter three 2009, which is kind of interesting if you consider we're at all-time highs on markets right now. Now, also, there was, if you remember, the earnings decline for quarter two was -5.5% when we saw the estimates on June 30th. So it's becoming a little bit better. -3.7% is the earnings decline in the S&P on a quarter-over-quarter basis, on a year-over-year basis. And we're seeing it now currently at the current stage with 25% of the companies that have reported showing only a 3.7% decline. Upside earnings surprise have been led by industrials and information technology companies. Now, in terms of guidance, we saw that in the forward quarter of the companies that have already issued guidance, about 14 companies have issued negative EPS guidance and five companies have issued positive EPS guidance. The rest are pretty much in line. But right now, the forward PE currently of the S&P 500, assuming a 12-month forward of $127, which is going to be a little bit hard to believe, is at 17, which is well above the five-year average. I would say that really the actual numbers, if we can look at what a reasonable level of growth is going to be on the S&P 500, would probably be somewhere more around probably 19 to 20. All depends on what information you're looking at. Now, more importantly than what we did see is that next week, we have about 200 companies, about 50% of the S&P 500 is going to be reporting next week. The biggest one that will really be the most important when it comes to the earnings is Apple. Now, Apple is scheduled to report on July 26th, I believe it is. Yeah, the 26th of July. And they're going to be reporting for the calendar second quarter, which is the fiscal third quarter for Apple. And they're looking for about $1.40. That's the mean estimate of Apple's earnings compared to last year, where the actual was $1.85. So the year ago period was $1.85. The current estimate is $1.40. Now, the question is this a low bar? Is this just a level that is very low because analysts are really concerned about, let's say, iPhone sales and Mac sales, and they're really setting the bar low like we've seen for many companies? Remember something, Goldman Sachs reported last week. They beat by a level of, I think, close to 65 cents, I believe it was. But that was because the earnings were brought down so significantly over the last 3 months. Now, if Apple's numbers come in as scheduled, this will be the first time that Apple reported two consecutive quarters on a year-over-year earnings basis of a decline. This goes back to 2013, quarter two and quarter three. So as a result of the projected decline in EPS for Apple, it's expected to be, of course, the largest contributor to the expected earnings decline for the S&P information technology sector for quarter two. Now, what's more interesting about all of this is now at this point, while we expected the next quarter, not this current quarter, but next quarter to show somewhat of a leveling off, analysts are starting to kick back their estimates and we're looking for another decline in the following quarter, where analysts, of course, are saying, well, the fourth quarter probably will be good. So I guess a lot of this all depends on what's going to actually play out post-Brexit, what's going to happen with the economy, with the low interest rates that we've seen recently, and with the overall potential for companies to do well in the face of a dollar actually gaining momentum of late. I'm going to watch Apple and many other companies. Anyway, great report here by FactSet. You can download those over at FactSet.com. I believe it is each and every week. But anyway, lots happening next week. We're going to keep our eye on earnings. It's going to be very interesting to watch if the markets can continue to pace higher with the realization that earnings are not only declining for five consecutive quarters, but also the next quarter is now expected to do the same thing. Anyway, let's get to our guest and see what he has to say about the psychology of all this. And our special guest today is Dr. Daniel Crosby, author of The Laws of Wealth, Psychology, and the Secret to Investing Success. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Personal Benchmark. Dr. Crosby, how are you, buddy?
I'm awesome. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. You know, I'm impressed with the book. I told you offline one of the things I love about the book. And by the way, listeners, if you gotta do what I'm about to tell you. The book, I don't know what it is, but he puts some magical something on the cover and the pages. It's probably one of the nicest feeling books, not only from a reading standpoint, but the actual touch of the cover. I don't know. What do you do with that? How do you get that?
My publisher sent me a UK stock almanac. And I read it, and I was like, I didn't love the book, but whatever is on this cover, make my cover just like this. And they
did. It's fabulous. It's really, I've never felt a book this, I don't know what it is, soft. And it's like almost like a super ultra suede or something.
It is. That's a good description.
But let's talk about the book. And I wanted to talk about the whole concept of this whole, you know, this whole area of behavioral finance. And why it's important. You may, in the beginning of the book, one of the first chapters you wrote, number one, you must invest in risk assets to survive. Number two, you are psychologically ill-equipped to invest in risk assets, which kind of sums up the whole game, I think, for a lot of people in terms of you know, how they approach their investing. But I want you to, why don't you start with what is behavioral finance?
So behavioral finance, I mean, there's complicated explanations for it, but I'm from Alabama, so we'll skip all that. So behavioral finance is just finance that tries to incorporate the messiness of human nature into it. You know, historically, neoclassical economics has been built on some simplified assumptions or has left out the people involved altogether to try and build pretty mathematical models. And so behavioral finance wants to sort of reinvest the blood and guts and gore and irrationality of human behavior into the equation, even if it doesn't make the math quite as simple.
So, I mean, there's so many components of behavioral finance, and it's actually become a bit of a codicil industry where there are hedge funds and even algorithms that are based on this these days, right?
Yeah, I've got one of them.
Okay, there you go. And it's funny because, you know, maybe in the old days, I guess one of the earliest forms, this could have been the concept of a contrarian investor and a trend trader, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the way that I manage money, it's based on value and momentum, which I think are sort of the two anomalies that persist largely because they have psychological underpinnings. You know, a lot of the anomalies that have been discovered through the ages get sort of arbitraged away quickly because they're easy to implement. But I'm of the bias that anything that has psychology as sort of its root is going to stick around because people are I'm long human stupidity from here to forever, basically.
But you know what? Sometimes, I mean, listen, you know, there is the issue of trend and momentum and value. So it's interesting because value is a moving target, isn't it?
Well, I mean, a lot of what I would consider value, you know, if you look at what are labeled marketed value funds today, I mean, I looked at one the other day that had an average PE of 24. I mean, right. that's not a value play to me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think those terms do get muddied and watered down.
So the whole idea of behavioral finance, also you can think of things like, you know, blood in the streets. This is more contrarian, I guess. There's blood in the streets. Hey, I'm going to buy. Why? Well, people are panicking. But they don't only panic on the way down. They panic on the way up, which is kind of what's happening now, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like we've put together a really solid 6 or 7 years based on things being not quite as horrible as we thought. Like, you know, we've had this sort of steadily improving economy, but really exceptional gains over the, you know, the past 7 years because people have remained panicked, I think, as a result of, you know, the Great Recession. And things have been slightly better than maybe you hypothesized, and I think the market's risen steadily on that. And so it's interesting. I mean, right now I'm of the mind that the market is quite overvalued, but that's not a function of sort of the frothy, irrational exuberance that's largely been assumed to be what drives markets up to levels like this before. So it's sort of an interesting case study. I think we live in strange and wonderful times.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I find the most interesting is, you know, you do see these exhaustion moves a lot of times. We have a couple of different indicators that what I have found is that very sharp and intense moves to the downside are often bought very quickly, not only in the last couple of years, but generally speaking, you know, people would much rather buy if they, you know, if they see that, hey, wait a minute, there's an opportunity here. Whereas overbought conditions, we'll call it, so we'll call it oversold versus overbought. Overbought conditions can last a very long time. What is the psychology with that?
Oh, geez. I think that, you know, things we've seen recently like Brexit and other things where you have a sharp, precipitous drop, I think most investors who know anything know that you should buy low and sell high. And so they go, oh, cool, a buying opportunity. But I think when you have more gradual descent like you talked about, I think that the fear really starts to set in and grip people in ways that education is out the door and the emotion takes over. That's just my best guess on that. But I think it's a cogent and a good observation, though. I've seen the same thing, even though I've never articulated it quite the way you just did.
So when you look, another part of the book talks about, and actually you spend a lot of time in the book, in the first couple of maybe three chapters, discussing how, which I think is interesting. It's from myself being an advisor. I know you're also, but how you're really benefited by using an advisor, which flies right in the face of everything that's going on today with the tradition, with classic robo-advising or ETFs that are kind of low-cost, just buy and hold, broad-based S&P or, you know, NASDAQ ETFs. But you really go through a lot of the discussion about how utilizing an advisor in the area of maybe not traditionally thinking of it as an investment advisor for making picks, but from a coaching standpoint, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think, I say in the book, you need a financial advisor, but probably not for the reason that you think. And so Natixis did some really cool research recently where they asked advisors, you know, what's the greatest value that you add to your clients' lives? And 83% of the advisors said the greatest value I add is, you know, behavioral coaching, hand-holding, keeping people from doing stupid things. And then they turn around and ask the, you know, couple hundred clients of those advisors, you know, the same question, and only 6% of the individuals they ask thought that the advisor's primary value was keeping them from making poor decisions. So we have a pretty pretty huge gap between what advisors know they do in terms of adding value and how that value is marketed and understood by the investing public. And so hopefully this book is a step in the right direction to have people look at their advisor as more of a behavioral coach and less of a sort of a mini Warren Buffett. Because the research is pretty unequivocal that people who work with an advisor do 2-3% better per year than those who do it themselves. And over a 30-year investment lifetime, I mean, you can double your wealth on 3% a year. So it's a big deal.
You know, it's interesting because there's a couple of different things that you bring up in the book as examples and also factual studies. But one of the things that you talk about when it comes to this whole idea of, the advisor thinks that they're doing this and the investor or the client, if you will, thinks that maybe the advisor is doing that. And it reminds me of a story that, you know, when I was in a room and the question was asked, well, who here thinks you're an above average driver? You know, you're a good driver. 85-90% of the people raised their hand, right? And you could take this over into the area of investing if you like, the same question. But you know, when you think about the averages in that room, well, if there's 100 people in the room and 90 people think that they're above average or above average of the amount of people in the room, well, that just can't be, right?
That's, yeah, sure.
Not the law of averages. So the thing is that there's an overconfidence thing, which we're going to get into a second because you have this as one of your areas of managing behavioral risk. But you also talk about, I think it's, now there was a Greek, now what was his name? Pericles? No.
Procrustes?
Procrustes. Yeah, what a terrible name, by the way.
Right.
But Procrustes, you had this story about Procrustes. And Procrustes basically that was the story about the guy with the leprosy, right?
Oh, so Procrustes cuts your legs off. Are you talking about
that? That was another good story. I'm talking about the one where you had, maybe it was the Romans and they had the slave behind them.
Oh, geez, I have a lot of Greek stuff in there. Yes. So the look behind you and know that you're a man, one?
Yeah, exactly.
Memento mori. Yeah, so when Roman generals would win a great battle, they would, you know, bring them home and parade them around the Colosseum, and they do these big chariot things, and people are throwing flowers and telling them how great they are. And so behind them in the chariot, though, they have a slave whispering in the gentleman's ear, memento mori, which is, you know, in effect, look behind, someday you will die. Like, look behind you and know that you are just a man. And so at the very moment that they're celebrating their greatness, they're making efforts to keep them in check, keep them humble, and say, hey, you're just a man. And I think that is just an awesome embodiment of what we ought to be doing as investors is, you know, be happy when you make money, realize there's oftentimes a lot of luck involved, and don't let that emotion make you a stranger to your rules.
And I think that also takes you into, if there's not someone behind you saying, hey, you know, look back, look at all the options, that as investors, that as we're actually making that trade, realize that emotions can get the best of you and the story can get the best of you. And that, you know, make sure that you're investing with the right theory behind what you're doing, not just following, oh, that guy on TV just blew a horn and made a noise with a tambourine and that must be a good stock. You know, it's the kind of putting it all in perspective just for a moment from a grounding standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, 2 to 3% a year is incredible. But in order to take advantage of that, people need to see their advisors as providing that value. So that's part of the messaging of the book that I hope's getting out there.
Now, let's talk about the S&P 500 as a benchmark, because this is an area also that has been, I think, has blossomed into something that is totally ridiculous. You know, I have a client, for example, that we have a portfolio. And let's just say, for an example, that the portfolio is blended, very simply as an example, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, but the stocks maybe are domestic and international, small cap, large cap, and all that. Now, just by the very nature of that, if you think about that, and everybody's happy with that due to a lot of different reasons, a lot of different discussion went into it, and okay, that's the portfolio that I'm comfortable with from a risk standpoint, right? So set the stage. However, now they start looking at the S&P 500 as the sole benchmark. Well, there may be times in life that they're going to be very happy that they don't have full equity exposure, right? There may be times in life that they're very miserable with the fact that, wait a minute, the S&P is up 10%, I'm only up 6, I'm only up 5, I'm only up 2. But the problem is the S&P 500 benchmark something that anybody should be using? Or, first of all, I know we talk about goal-based benchmarking in the book, but, you know, really more matching it to, well, we maybe should be in the MSCI World Index as 60% and the Barclays Aggregate as 40%. That's much more of a real look at what should be a benchmark. But why are we all using the S&P 500? Why is it all, you know, the TV's littered with this and how the S&P does, and why is everybody kind of on this?
Yeah, so I think that our clients, you know, began to use this because of part of what you pointed out, which is just the ubiquity of it. I mean, you know, it comes preloaded on your iPhone. Even if you're listening to non-financial channels, if you're listening to NPR or something, I mean, they're going to interrupt you every 10 minutes to tell you what the Dow and the S&P are doing. And so the ubiquity of it, I think, is what makes it, you know, top of mind for our clients. I think that also another reason it's been used more recently is because it's done so well. I mean, and so I think clients are frustrated if they are in a sensible 60-40 domestic and, you know, domestic and foreign mix of equities and fixed income. You know, they have underperformed the S&P dramatically, even though they've been in the right stuff. I mean, they've been doing what's right. But what's right and what's sexy and what's top of mind are very different things. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, the ubiquity of it and just the, it's been advantageous recently. Because I promise you, if in, you know, 2 or 3 years the market starts to tank, no one's going to come to us and say, hey, thanks for having me diversified. you know, the people use the benchmark that's convenient to meet the end they want to meet.
Yeah. Now, There's some other things that I thought were really interesting in the book. Again, we're talking to Dr. Daniel Crosby, author of The Laws of Wealth, Psychology, and The Secret of Investing Success. I'm sure you can get it in all sorts of places, online and wherever you can get books. And in this case, maybe even the handbag section, because it's such a nice... yeah, we should turn this into a handbag.
That's
such a
true.
Nice exterior. you talk about analysts.
Yes.
I call them analysts, but nonetheless... you know, seriously, you know, you want to believe the meat of their story. You want to believe that an analyst at Goldman or JP or Citi or Merrill, whoever it is providing you good information, metrics, outlook, storyline, and you know, full detail of the situation. However, we also know that there's a high propensity of analysts to put a buy signal on or buy rating on a stock. And you talk about in the book that there is this weird incentive program that's really set up by the between the companies, if you will, and also the analysts, that make it almost close to impossible for them to give you accurate and unbiased research.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of things wrong. I mean, first of all, it's just enormously hard. I mean, it's just enormously hard to get it right. David Dreeman looked at nearly 80,000 consensus analyst estimates and found that only 5% of the, or only one time in 170 were they within 5% of the actual price. So, I mean, first of all, it's just tough. And then you add to it this sort of perverse incentive that you spoke about, which is there's absolutely a buy bias, and that's been growing with time. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's grown exponentially with time. Analysts have gotten more and more prone to issue buy signals over time. And then the other thing is, if they publish a bad report or give a sell signal for a company, they tend to be stonewalled by the company themselves or even the bank or the brokerage firm that's hired them. So they tend to not get their phone calls returned. They tend not to have access to the work that they need. So there's, in many ways, a very perverse incentive for them to give the answer that the street wants and not the one that's best for investors. So it's hard on its face, and then it's made doubly hard by the way that's incentivized.
The other problem is that buy-side research versus sell-side research. Sell-side research is usually free, generally speaking, freely available, accessible, and then fully quoted and requoted and repurposed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas buy-side research, which is more of the hedge funds and internal research of companies or maybe subscription-only types of research, is not very available. And in a world that we live in that everything is free, right? I mean, if I can't get something for free, man, I'm like, I'm not getting a subscription to that. I'll find it somewhere else for free, right?
Right.
Seriously. I mean, I can get everything for free. So in a world that everything, and we wonder why there's no inflation, by the way, right? So in a world that everything's free and people looking for easy access to this, where they either go on their free Yahoo Finance account, because God forbid they buy a, you know, premium account somewhere, or they go on, and even the people that are utilizing many of the subscription services, are the writers themselves are using free information.
Yeah,
to then spit out. So now what you're getting is just a kind of a exponential view of the same information rotated and spit back at you, and therefore you're not getting maybe what is more of a truly unbiased opinion. Because if you get a sell rating on a stock and the company then stonewalls you, can't do reports on them in the future, and not to mention the fact that sell side gets paid by trading.
Right.
So big problems there. Let's talk about some passive investing. You talk about passive investing over active management. So first of all, let's kind of discuss and define what is passive investing versus active management investing.
Yeah, so passive investing is investing that seeks to mirror a benchmark. So, like the S&P 500 index would be a capitalization weighted index of the 503 or whatever it is companies in the S&P. And active management is where managers actively try and select individual stocks that they think will outperform.
One of the things that's interesting is that just like value versus growth versus like styles, domestic versus international, bonds versus stocks, active versus passive management also have cycles, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think in the last year or so, fund flows have gone 3-1 for passive vehicles, because passive investing has dramatically whooped up on active investing over the last, well, certainly over the last 10 years. 83% of passive vehicles have beat their active brethren. And so you see with that, that fund flows tend to go their way. And then, you know, I think everything in the market is cyclical. One of the things I talk about, one of my chapters says excess is never permanent. I think there will come a time when the delta between active and passive management is probably not as great as it's been the last 5 to 7 years, and I think you'll see people chase returns the other way. So,
I have found, by the way, in my research, is that the longer a market goes in a direction, particularly up, of course, and the more complacent and let's say the less concerned people have about ever seeing another downstroke, the more passive management gets play.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So think about that in terms of what's happening with markets here. But what about the whole, the wave of robo-investing? Now, there's different types of it, and I think that I've told my listeners that we are in the process, actually, of setting up a quote-unquote advisor-assisted platform, which is kind of, goes to the first thing we talked about, which is to make sure people don't do anything stupid, but at the same time have the access to, if they don't want to deal with the traditional advisor platform where, you know, you work with somebody one-on-one and you go through the whole process, well, it's all automated for you to a degree. But let's go to the core and base where there's Betterment and Wealthfront and all these different companies that are doing, just ask me 3 questions or 5 questions or 10 questions and magically they know what your risk tolerance is. Everybody's put into a box and they're on their own. The only thing they do is really a bit of a tax harvesting possibly, and also a rebalancing, maybe quarterly, let's say, but utilizing passive investment strategy. So this is a passive investment strategy, right? Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I think they would agree with that. Betterment and Wealthfront. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, you know, is there a problem with this? Is there something in how, is it just, oh, well, the millennials are doing this, or is it something in the behavioral science world and behavioral finance world that is saying, well, this is why they're doing it?
So, I mean, there's 2 parts. In my book, I talk, you know, part one is about managing yourself, and part two is about managing your wealth, like making investment decisions. So I think something that Betterment and company do well is manage your wealth just in terms of giving you a reasonable scientific asset allocation. So that's not the hard part, though. The hard part is managing yourself. And frankly, I'm going to take a back seat and just see how these folks perform. I think that we will know sooner than later how the Betterments and Wealthfronts of the world do in down markets, because that's really where the value gets added. I mean, it's quite easy to Google a sensible asset allocation and do that yourself.
Yep.
But people don't tend to stick with that. So I know that Betterment, I know Betterment in particular has a head of behavioral finance there who's working actively to try and insert some behavioral principles into the way that they do things. Whether or not they're able to keep people in their seats when things get rocky remains to be determined to me. And I think the future is probably somewhere in the middle, like you said, which is the slick technology, which my hat is off to the robo-advisors, to bringing to what has been a sort of clunky and antiquated fintech world, and then pairing that with human response. Because my guess is that people will be more likely to do the right thing if they have someone there talking them through it and holding their hand. That's my guess.
Yeah, I think that also one of the tests that we saw was after the Brexit vote and how the markets came down like 4% that day, that Friday. Remember that?
I do.
I think Betterment was closed to any trading till like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, Betterment closed their doors to trading until like mid-afternoon, and I thought that was an egregious misstep on their part.
Yep.
Because I think if that's what your folks have signed up for, then do that. But to shutter trading without telling people that that's what you were going to do, I thought was did a lot to erode trust, and I thought that was a big mistake.
I agree. Let's get on a couple of things else in your book here. In the chapter entitled Managing Behavioral Risk, you discuss several types of risk. You talk about ego risk, emotional risk, information risk, attention risk, and conservation risk. Kind of those go, you know, through the whole gamut of definitive types of areas that you could fall down in terms of being an investor. But where's the most important one there? Is there one?
I don't know that there's one. What I tried to do there was make a contribution to the behavioral research by saying it had been pretty muddled, frankly. So we had identified psychologists and, you know, sociologists had identified like 117 different ways that you could screw it up, like 117 different ways for you to make cognitive errors and mistakes. But all 100 plus of those loaded onto one of about a handful of sort of broader psychological underpinnings. And so what I tried to do there is take the 100 plus and say, hey, look, you're not going to manage 100 different ways to screw this up. And that's not a very empowering message to investors. But like, to use a couple of examples, ego risk is, you know, keeping that overconfidence in check. You know, I cite research in the book where I think it's, they interviewed a bunch of men, 95% of the men thought they were better looking than average, 97% of the men thought that they were funnier than average, and 100% of the men thought that they were more interpersonally savvy than average. And, you know, like you said, the math doesn't work. So that's ha-ha in our personal lives, but it's no joke when you bring that kind of ego to your investment life. So right. I wanted to take those five things and say, look, if you can get good information, if you can overcome your natural tendency to be loss averse, if you can keep your ego in check through following rules and working with an advisor, you're going to be okay. You don't have to worry about 117 different ways to get it wrong.
Now, one of the things, I mean, there's so many things to talk about, your four C's of rule-based behavioral investing, the five P's of equity investing. One of the things I wanted to kind of ask you about was the use of behavioral finance and behavioral science, really, in a world where there are others trying to mold our thoughts. So there's one thing about trying to understand the behavioral finance world from the aspect of playing chess against other players that are buying and selling stocks, right? Or, you mm-hmm. know, investments. So that's kind of the game, right? So it's poker. It's poker. I mean, it's, you know, it's poker, although with poker, when you play poker, you can bluff and you can make money. You can't really bluff in the world of stocks, right? It doesn't work so well. Yeah, I'm going to put all my money in and just see if that other guy goes out. No, that ain't happening. Unless you have a lot of money. However, that does work when it comes to if you have unlimited funds. Wouldn't you agree with that?
So bluffing works if you have what?
Absolutely.
Yeah, tell me more. I'm not sure I understand.
Well, think of a central bank.
Oh, got it. Okay,
central bank. Yeah. Central bank says, hey, we're thinking about doing this, or we're going to use all of our tools that are available to us. You know, there is no limitation to whatever. They use all these words. It's a bluff. They may do it, but I'm saying the words initially are a bluff just to try to move markets into a particular mentality.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I've been as critical as anyone of the actions of central banks over the last few years and am frustrated, sort of perpetually frustrated by their actions. And then the other thing is, it's interesting, I talk about share buybacks in the book. And when management announces a share buyback, the stock price tends to rise over the next year, whether or not they actually do it. So there's no doubt that that management can sort of bluff the price of a stock, and that central banks can bluff the broader market. Yep. But yeah.
And you as an investor that obviously then has to deal with your own emotional risk based on the information risk, right? You don't know what's true and what's not. You also don't know how, you know, I don't want to lose money. Listen, nobody wants to lose money. And that becomes a big problem, obviously. So now if you go against whatever it is, whether the central bank says, we're going to raise rates, well, maybe I'll take some money off the table here because I don't want to. Or if they say, hey, we're going to lower rates. And if you're short, let's say, or if you're not invested now, oh, man, I want to make that money, or I don't want to lose the money if I'm short. You know, that's where those whole things come into play. Whereas you can't bluff if I'm just going to say, well, I'm going to put $100,000 into this particular stock and then everybody's going to move it up because of me. That's not going to happen. But politicians, brokerage firms, stockbrokers, I mean, they all come in, you know, how are they all molding our thoughts? Aren't they all part of the process?
Well, they are. And that's where I've had some success in combining value and momentum approaches. I mean, I grew up, you know, I sort of came up through the business steeped in a Ben Graham, Warren Buffett, you know, Joel Greenblatt style value investing, and used to rail against the market or the central banks or whoever for being wrong. Mm-hmm. And you've seen a lot of this from hedge fund managers recently writing these snarky letters about how they're right and the market's wrong. And you know, what the psychology and what the sentiment and the technical piece has given me is a way to say, you know, reality is sort of a mutually agreed upon illusion in the market. And reality is what we all say it is. And you can't scream, you can't howl at the moon for the market being wrong. You just have to combine seemingly incompatible approaches. And so, you know, I look at valuations as telling me basically the potential for mean reversion. Like, you know, if a market's very steeply valued, like I think it is now, there's a lot of potential energy for bad things to happen. But that doesn't get actualized until the kinetic energy of a negative catalyst is kicked in. And so I don't get as angry anymore because I've learned to say, hey, reality is what everyone thinks it is. And so if Janet Yellen wants to, you know, talk about this or that, then I got to play along. It doesn't do me any good to scream about it.
But what happens when reality is, let's look at the Brexit vote and what the fallout after that. So it was, you know, a few days, 3 days of a down market, maybe too steep. Not disagreeing that it was very quick and everybody didn't know what to do because it was a surprise. So now you have the kinetic energy that hit in, right?
Mm-hmm.
With high valuations at that time. And now you have kinetic energy that kicked in and all of a sudden the reality changed on a dime. And not only did it change on a dime, everybody's like, oh, that's gone in the past. And we've become very short-sighted, right? Very like, you know, yesterday was a year ago.
Yeah. So there's two things here. So the first is realizing that you're not always going to be right. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I look at this, so in some of my models, it's like, you know, when we have steep valuations and poor momentum, the average next year's return is negative 8% a year. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty good model, right? When you have steep valuations and bad momentum. But about half the time, it's flatter up. You know, so you don't always get it right. So you have to say, okay, first of all, there's no perfect formula. I'm never going to get this all the way right. And the second thing is you don't look at it that much. I mean, I look at this stuff once a month, because if you looked at every up and down of the market, right, I mean, you'd be crazy. Right. And I think part of what behavioral finance teaches us is that the truth tends to come out in the wash over the medium term.
Yeah, the short term obviously is noisy. You know, it's very noisy. Medium term, less noisy. Long term, really. I mean, it's like, do I look at a 60-minute chart, a daily chart, a weekly chart, or a monthly chart, right? Each one of those provides good information for any particular time period and trading style. However, the longer you go out, it's like averages. It's moving averages. The longer you go out, the more smooth the whole process gets. Looking at a weekly chart, for example, for a stock gives me, I think, pretty good insight into what's happening, and a daily a chart if I'm thinking about doing an investment over a period of time. If you're going to do an investment on a very short period of time, you know, a 30-minute chart may do it for you. I know some people that use 5-minute charts, and I've seen people use tick charts, which I don't even understand how that works.
Yeah, I don't get any of that stuff. I wouldn't begin to know how to look at a 5-minute chart.
Yeah, 5-minute chart is very tight. I mean, the thing is about a 5-minute chart, just for my audience, really, a 30-minute chart is 6 5-minutes put into the same thing. I mean, it smooths it out a lot more. You don't have to worry about some weird ticks and weird movements. And what's the point of that? Because you're getting the same basic range, captures all the prices, right, on a 30-minute chart or a 60-minute chart or whatever you're looking at here. Anyway, Daniel Crosby, the Laws of Wealth author and Psychology of the Secrets of Investing Success, also author of the best-selling book called Personal Benchmark, has been my guest today. Thanks so much, buddy. I appreciate it. We'll have you on again soon. I think this is really fascinating.
Thanks so much. It was great.
All right. Bye-bye. And that's going to pretty much wrap it up for this week's edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for listening to me and our guests. And of course, tune in each and every week to not only this show, but also DH Unplugged. Of course, I mentioned that next week I'll be the guest on Frank Curzio's podcast. You can listen to the Benzinga interview from last week as well. And of course, get our commentary, the Horowitz Company commentary on economics and markets and what's going on. Put one out for everyone to download over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This particular episode, you can get the download when you go to the show notes of that. Just head on over there. You'll find it. Thanks a lot for joining me, and I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.